Market Music with Fairbairn and Russell.
Hello and welcome to the Market Musings podcast, where today our guest is George Roach, who is the CEO of Premier African Minerals. So, hi George, and welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Yeah, I'm well, thank you, and it's nice to be chatting to you guys. Hi.
Yes, absolutely. And where are you? Where are you calling us from today?
At the moment, I'm sitting in the Midrand area of South Africa. It's halfway between Johannesburg and Pretoria. Kind of semi-locked down, but not completely.
Okay.
We've got a little bit of movement thanks to some relaxation of COVID, but otherwise fairly restrained.
Okay. And of course, we have Kenny as well, as usual.
Yeah. Hi, George. How's things?
Yeah. Hi. Not too bad. Thank you. Nice to chat to you.
Yeah, unfortunately, Scotland, we seem to have went into a deeper lockdown. In fact, they're actually talking about shutting the border between Scotland and England, which is causing a lot of, unless it's essential travel. So there's a lot of talk at the moment, and I don't think many people are happy with our illustrious leader. But we'll keep that for another day. But no, it's strange how we seem to be getting relaxed out of COVID and then we're back locked down again. Nobody knows if we're coming or going, but at least it's an international podcast. I'm in Scotland, Mark's in Holland, and you're in South Africa, George, so we get about. Mm. So it's good. But no, I'm delighted to have you on the podcast, George. And what we like to do in this podcast is we like to find out a lot about the director or the CEO and what you've done in the past, what your successes have been, you know, what your education was like, what your childhood was like, where you grew up. You know, just, it's really a platform for you, George, just to give us, you know, a mini life story and how we got to the point we're at now. So it's over to you, George. You can go back as far as you want, or you can start at a suitable point and just tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, you're happy to do that. I must say your comments on England and Scotland are quite amusing. I thought that there was a long-lasting movement to re-establish the wall, but nevertheless.
Oh, I think she's putting a virtual one up at the moment. So,
yeah, a virtual one.
Well, it'll be interesting because my son's in the Navy and he's due to go back down south very soon. So I'm hoping that's classed as essential travelling, but we'll soon see.
I think it will be. Yeah. Now, I just coming back to myself for the moment, I was sort of mulling it over in advance of this chat, and I was just thinking to myself that I suppose I'm best described as a serial entrepreneur with a little bit of a social conscience that goes with it. The social conscience, I think, is something that's essential to achieve some of the things that we have managed to achieve in the African environment. So often, an entrepreneur is purely results and money driven, and I'm not entirely that way. I think that that monetary success is a necessary means to sustainability and sustainable environments and success. But without some acceptable social relationship, particularly in the African context, you're not going to achieve the overall objectives that you want. So, you know, I think that kind of goes back and describes a lot of how I've got to where I am. I didn't start life as a mining engineer or as a geologist. Earth sciences have always interested me, but were never an essential component of anything that made money. Until around about the late 80s, I suppose, late 80s, early 90s. It's quite an interesting side story, I suppose, that a number of us had established a trading enterprise that was trading out of Dubai primarily and into various African countries. And we had a man in Burkina Faso who was responsible for selling and collecting funds from various items that we were shipping in. And he kind of got hold of us, or one of the Sharjah-based head office guys got hold of me and said to me that this guy hadn't been collecting money. He'd been collecting gold mining licenses. And the gold mining licenses were some of the better known concessions today in Burkina Faso. And basically they came to me and said, "You're in South Africa. You're involved in gold mining. What do we do with these things?" And although, as I say, earth sciences had always intrigued me and been very close to me, it was the first time that I was put in a position where, for business reasons, I had to go out and deal with it. And we did successfully deal with it. And today, some of those areas are successful mines in Burkina Faso and operating right now. So it was quite an interesting a start to what, over a period of a relatively short period of time, became my only and exclusive concern, which was the development of natural resources in the different African territories and countries.
Yeah, and what was it you done before that, George? I know you touched on it. It was shipping goods.
Yeah, the trading entity was one of a number of things that I was involved in. If I go right back to my initial post school years, I was involved with financial institutions in South Africa, and I became, cutting a long story short, became quite frustrated with the environment I was in. In the late 70s, I was data processing manager for one of the South African building societies, and was trying very hard to implement systems that relate to what we do today with mag stripe on cards and so on and so forth. And we kind of had a few fuddy-duddies at the GM level who couldn't quite understand what we were going to do, and we didn't have a little passbook to print our balances in. And to cut a long story short, my frustration at the time, I think, boiled over, and I actually said to these guys that they were wrong. If they persisted in the route they were going to go down, they'd find they were wrong within 18 months and get taken over by somebody else. And the only thing that was wrong with the prediction was that the time frame wasn't 18 months, it was 12 months. And that also, I think, led me to conclude that I didn't think I was employable at that time. I really didn't think I could work in a corporate type of environment at all. It just didn't suit me. And I took a sabbatical. I was in a fortunate position financially at the time that I was able to take a sabbatical for a period and mulled over, at the princely age of, I think I was 30 at the time, exactly what I was going to do. 30, a young family, houses, mortgage loans, et cetera, all the things that I suppose go with one at that stage in one's life. And I took a couple of months and mulled over what I was going to do. And generally had a mixed following 10 odd years that involved interests in the food industry. I developed quite a few of those. I was involved with one of the big food franchises in South Africa. It took me into the agricultural sector, into basic food production. That's coming back to the natural resource side. And into trading. And that, of course, brings us back to the UAE-based trading enterprise into Africa, which kind of completes very much an abridged period of 10, 20 years back into the mining resource-based development. Mm-hmm. So interesting, quite a wide range of interests, which I still tend to maintain. My principal concerns are obviously in mineral resource development, but I do also have interests in agriculture and some quite large interests in significant land holdings in the Mozambique area and so on. So those are the, as I say, the principal areas of interest today.
Yeah. So you picked up these licenses, George, in Burkina Faso. What was the, where did these end up? Did you take them to a certain level and sell them on to listed companies, or what was the process?
As I recall, Rand Mines was one of those that took some of these licenses off our hands in those days. I didn't necessarily follow that particularly closely. I hadn't been to Burkina Faso at that time. I was much more concerned with trade into the SADC region than necessarily there. So it really was a case of how do we kind of get rid of these. But it's interesting that the late 80s, early 90s, there were major changes coming in the South African environment, politically and so on. And it over a period of probably from early 90s through to around about 2000, I moved closer on an ongoing basis to moving into full-time mineral resource development, working with a number of other people, a number of other different companies and so on along the way. But it wasn't completely full-time. It became full-time from around about the very early 2000s and became the sole concern that I had from the entrepreneurial and development perspective.
Yep. Yeah, I'm just looking at your bio list now. So you're also involved, George, in some TSX companies as well?
Yes, I was. You know, I think some of the more interesting ones, and there's some, I think, quite entertaining situations that have happened subsequent to 2000. And I mean, some of them involved, I'm thinking who was listed on London, Central Rand Gold. Central Rand Gold had a listing on London. Now, I was never involved with Central Rand Gold, but the precursor to Central Rand Gold was an Australian entity called Rand Quest Syndicate. And that was run by a Australian geo by the name of Harry Mason. And Harry Mason had come to South Africa looking for gold opportunities. He became involved with two very prominent South African geos, who are Morris and Richard Viljoen, who people in the mining industry will know very, very well indeed. Harry became ill and could not complete what he was doing. He suffered from a diabetes and a heart condition. And I was asked, I think by Morris, to get involved in assisting with some of the early commercial side of sorting this out, which we eventually were able to do. I did a lot of the negotiation for the acquisition from Anglo-American. And from, well, one, I can't even remember some of the other entities that I worked with at the time. But basically, we put together and assisted quite strongly with that. That company went on and became listed. I was not involved with them at all at the time of the listing. But the relationship with Morris and Richard was very strong and remains today. I have a huge amount of respect for them as geologists. And I had started looking at which minerals or which metals may be coming into favor and demand may be increasing, and where I could try and take early positions. And into mid-2004, I had an associate, another different Australian associate, who asked me if I could start looking for uranium properties. And I did, and put together eventually a string of properties in the Beaufort West area in South Africa, a place called the Rayscale Channel, and also the Trekopje deposit in Namibia, and then subsequently deposits in Central African Republic and one or two other countries as well. And that had started mid-early 2004. In January 2005, interest in uranium was picking up. And I was then introduced to a couple of significant Canadian entrepreneurs who were very keen on working in the uranium space. Cut a long story short, in March 2005, I think it was, there was a little company called Uranco that was registered. And Uranco set about acquiring these properties that I was working very closely on in the Rayscale Channel in South Africa, subsequently Trekopje in Namibia. And right about the middle of 2005, a letter of demand arrived one day from one of the prominent patent attorneys here in South Africa. And this was a demand that I cease and desist with the use of the name Uranco immediately, or they were going to issue summons and do whatever they were going to do. And I have to say that my initial reaction to that was, wow, well, that's great news, because any dispute like this is going to go in the public domain and everybody's going to know about this company, until some of the prominent other shareholders and directors, particularly the Canadian side of this and the UK side, pointed out to me that the reason for this was that the similarity of Uranco to Urenco, which is the uranium reprocessing, whatever it is, set up, was just too close, and that the shareholders of the Uranco setup were a couple of European governments. So we decided we'd better have a look at renaming this thing. And the name we then came up with was Uramin. And Uramin, I think, is very familiar to most people. So that was kind of where the Uramin name came from. Interesting origin that was.
Mm. Yeah, I'm just trying to think back. Was that eventually taken over or bought out from memory, George?
Uramin was purchased by Areva, the French nuclear entity, in a deal that was worth $2.5 billion in June, July 2007. That's attracted a lot of interest over the years, and I think it still does, and there's still mountains of questions that keep on being asked. As to how they got to that price and why they paid this and that and whatever. And there's been allegations floated around for years and years and years, still ongoing. But I mean, the simple facts of the matter are that the price of uranium spiked dramatically. There are well-known facts that led to it, which was as much the disputes going on in Niger as the flooding at Cigar Lake. And the company was in a the French company was in a serious pickle. They needed to be assured of supply, and probably the best near term mine, large scale mine that could go into production very quickly, was the Trekopje mine in Namibia, which was a huge low grade deposit. It hasn't gone into production today. Factors have changed. But at the time, at the prices that uranium was sitting at the time, Trekopje was a great opportunity. And I think that's what underwrote their decision to go ahead. Sadly, that's been forgotten. You know, all you do is look at this massive amount of money and say, wow, how could you have paid so much? But it was real at the time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's definitely factors that influenced it. So after Uramin, George, what was the next stage in your career?
Yeah, so coming back sort of after Euroman, I was not with Euroman still. I'd retained quite a close relationship with everybody there at the time of the sale. But my concern is the entrepreneurial development side of this, or so I believed at the time. And after Euroman, a little bit of a sabbatical again, I decided to set up my own entity and go start chasing large-scale deposits in the African environment if I could. And that was a company that was established in 2008 called GNB African Resources. And for what it's worth, GNB African Resources changed its name in 2012 to Premier African Minerals. So that's where Premier African Minerals came from. And GNB African Resources at the time was a company that I held, was, well, my structures held 100% of it at that time. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of other associations that developed. Because of the time that I'd spent in 2006 in the Central African Republic, and one of the big licenses that Euroman had secured was the Bakuma license in the Central African Republic. And I'd basically lived in the Central African Republic from January till November 2006 to get all of that done. And it was challenging because there were French and Japanese interests who had done extensive work on the deposit, but had then relinquished this. So lots and lots and lots of competition in trying to secure that deposit. But we did at the end of the day, in what I think was a very good deal for both company and country. But having spent all this time there, I had also become conscious of the Axman deposits at a place called Pisandro in the Central African Republic. And it was clear to me with the very close associations I developed in the CAR with the Minister of Mines, the Office of the President to an extent, and various others, that there were some difficulties that Axman was going to run into. Axman not only had a gold deposit, but they also had what I think is today arguably the best undeveloped iron ore deposit in Africa. And that is at a place called Topa. And to find Topa is very easy. Take a pin and stick it into the middle of a map of Africa. And if you hit the middle, then you've hit the Topa iron ore deposit. And that's why it's undeveloped to this day. Yeah. It's a magnificent deposit. You know, when I say magnificent, over 90, around about 99% Fe2O3. It's a phenomenal deposit. It's DSO material, but there's no way to get it to market. And I cut a long story short, that eventually led to an approach from various people that ended up with me running the Axman company, which was TSX listed. And that's where the interest in Canada and the TSX listed company started. There were others. We secured some deposits in Ethiopia, for example, and that is now in the hands of a private company called Circum Minerals. It's, I think, going to develop into the lowest cost SOP producer in the world. I think that's where this one's heading. It's not in production yet, but it's others who run it. I retain, and Premier retains, a small interest to this day, but we think it's a high-value interest. So I spent quite a bit of time then in Toronto with Axman. We attempted to originally list the Ethiopian deposit in a company called Ethiopian Potash Company. Had some great beginnings, but sad endings. I'm just trying to think what else was there in Toronto. There were a lot of other bits and pieces in my time in Toronto. I almost became resident for a year or so. Wow. Yeah.
So, but in the background, Premier Minerals was always ongoing at this time, or the predecessor, the Premier Minerals.
Yeah, it was ongoing. GNB African Resources was ongoing. I had employed as an associate and who would become a shareholder, a man by the name of Bruce Cumming. He was a very accomplished senior ex-Falcon Bridge geo. And Bruce did a lot of the scouting and trying to secure deposits where we could. Zimbabwe is right next to where we are, and Bruce had lived in Zim for a period of time. So there were some good property opportunities in Zimbabwe, which Premier still has. We held quite extensive properties in West Africa. For a period of time, collectively between myself and two other of the more prominent Euroman shareholders, we probably had a controlling shareholding in a company called Lithic Metals, I think it was. Lithic, as I recall, was also TSX. So Prem acquired some of those, some went elsewhere. A lot of development, a lot of restructuring, a lot of fine-tuning, and that brings us to the point where Prem is today. Where Prem had actually gone ahead and developed the RHA mine in Zimbabwe and holds 100% in the Zulu lithium and tantalum deposit. And hopefully we're about to see an EPO being granted over that area that includes that deposit, which is likely to increase the mineral opportunity to include gold. Parts of the Fort Rixton Greenstone Belt run through the property very close to where our lithium deposit is. And there are some reports of some historic high-grade gold mining in that area too. So interesting prospects there.
Yeah. That brings us, you've kind of got up to the current day. That was my next line of questioning. I mean, obviously, there's been quite a lot going on with Prem in the last couple of months, a bit of restructuring, a bit of, well, obviously the company's debt-free this period in time. So I guess the question is, and quite a few of the listeners will probably be wanting me to ask this question as well, is, you know, what's different this time? What's going to make it a success for new shareholders and existing shareholders?
Okay, so just tracking back, into the Zimbabwe situation, the political environment, country risk and currency management that has taken place in Zimbabwe has been probably the biggest contributor to the loss in value and need for ongoing dilution and so on that Prem has suffered. And we've been incredibly patient in terms of trying to hold on and trying to work with the Zimbabwe government. For example, the RHA tungsten mine is 51% owned by an indigenization and economic empowerment company as part of the government of Zimbabwe. The policy was scrapped years ago. There have been so many promises to either fund their 51% of this or relinquish. And none of those have been met. So when you couple that to nearly 2 years of delay in getting the EPO granted, I can understand the frustration, because I feel the frustration myself, of being able to continue working in Zimbabwe. Premier's biggest asset, I think, is our existing shareholder base and the liquidity that we've developed. And I honestly believe that it's time to try and find another way of attracting shareholder value to our Zimbabwean assets and utilizing Prem's shareholder base and liquidity to move into other opportunities and effectively give us a double-edged sword kind of attack on this thing. So we've had very good support and from a body of shareholders, some of whom I know going back in time, but significant and substantial people who've supported a recent placing and who've supported the placing on the basis that we will look to ring fence our Zimbabwean operations from further spend and seek to find another mechanism for bringing value to those. Now, if that mechanism is a separate listing spin out of those, or a joint venture, or one of that and some other opportunities, that is where we will go with those, which then allows us to take Premier, reasonably well funded today, and to go and look at some other opportunities that have been presented to Premier. And those opportunities include some very good gold properties and gold potential in other parts of Africa. So that's that. And then at the same time, Premier, in its desire to have a cash generative asset, went out and looked for just that and has acquired to date 19% of a producing manganese mine in Namibia. Now, the operators of that manganese mine, which is privately run, are dead keen to try and cement a further deal with Prem. I think it's important to note that if we do, and if we do reach an agreement in terms of which Prem may acquire anything beyond where it is, then that is going to constitute an RTO under the AIM rules. And should we be able to, or should we go down that route, an RTO entails a suspension and so on and a relisting. So if that's going to happen, then the manganese deposits is going to have to stand up to significant scrutiny. So recently I've engaged independent mining engineering consultants and financial consultants, and I've been to site with them as well very, very recently. In fact, about 10 days ago, I drove to Namibia with them and am now back to do a proper and careful evaluation and valuation of that project. And based on that, we'll see if we can cement and if we should cement any further interest and go down that route. The sole objective, really, of getting involved in that manganese deposit and mine was to find a cash generative asset. Now, they are profitable. They need to be profitable to whatever extent is comfortable for Premier, to put Premier into a position where it doesn't have to go back to market again. Yep. So I think that kind of brings us pretty well full circle to where we are, the rationale for what we're trying to do and how we feel that we can get value back into the company.
Yeah, talk about sense here. I'm just looking at the actual manganese project at the moment. I mean, there's quite a lot of potential for expansion there as well of the resource.
Yeah, there's to my mind, there's huge potential, and the potential is not only in the resource, it's in the whole operation. I mean, this is run as a private company at this stage. Mm-hmm. Doesn't necessarily have the mining skills that it needs to have. In fact, they operate out of a number of pits, and one of the pits that they're operating out of at the moment isn't even contained within the resource statement, but yeah. It's a wonderful high-grade ore that's sitting there. You know, that'll give you an idea of just how much of an opportunity there is to get in and really sort out the operation.
Yeah, I'm just looking just now. So there's 144 kilometers of strike, and I think the current resource is only based in 13% of the strike length. So, there's definitely upside there. And I guess what's key as well, you know, for new investors is that obviously the company is now debt-free, which I don't think you guys have ever been in that position before.
Well, we were in the beginning when we listed. We were very much debt free right in the beginning. And in fact, I gave various personal undertakings way back in the beginning to ensure that the company had adequate working capital and so on. So we are now debt free. We'd accumulated significant debt over the last 3 years because of the decline and stalemate almost in Zimbabwe. So being debt free lifts a huge burden off us and puts us into a very strong position of being able to negotiate from a position of strength and not one where we can be compelled to do something we don't want to do. So that's good news. That's great news, I think.
Yep, definitely. Mark, do you think it's worth putting George on the spot with a 60-second challenge?
Certainly can.
Yeah, I think it's a good time to do it. Let's run it past him, see if he's up for it.
Okay, well, what we do, George, is often we ask our guests, particularly if they're management or CEO of listed companies, to do like a 60-second, almost like an elevator pitch. So it's 60 seconds where you have that time to effectively pitch the company to investors, current or people who may be interested, as to why the company you feel is a good investment proposition. So, yeah, we've put you on the spot, but if you're up for that, then we can have a go.
I have no problem at all talking about that. And in doing so, I'll summarize a couple of points.
Okay.
And let me start off by saying that one of Premier's greatest strengths lies in its broad shareholder base and its liquidity. If you buy into Prem, you can sell out of Prem. We don't want you to, but you can. And all you have to do is look at the history of liquidity in that. So that really does give you an opportunity to take a fair amount of comfort in terms of where you're putting your money. Secondly, we're at a really low point in terms of our value, in my view, at the moment. And to give you an indication on that, if we take our interest in Circum Minerals, I think our interest in Circum Minerals and the valuation that we have of the shares that we hold in Circum Minerals is not far short of the market capitalization of the company. Forget about what we can get in the future when we deal with a spin out or alternative in terms of our Zimbabwe assets. And then, of course, there's the upside coming in terms of gold that we can acquire, and the fact that resolve the valuation and other issues that I've spoken about associated with Otjozondu, and we become cash generative. So I think that those in combination should give one a lot more comfort in terms of getting involved in Prem at this point in time.
Okay, thank you. That's very good. And what's your view on the gold market at the moment and its near-term future?
You know, so many of the gold deposits that are available in Africa are really low OPEX operations. A lot of this is open pit, reasonable grades. There's a lot of free gold. And you are actually able to produce at a very, very low cost. Mm-hmm. And that cost in relation to where the price is at the moment is an absolute killer. You can make a pot of money at the moment, but you can also make money when the gold price is almost halved. So I think that there should be a lot of comfort in investment in gold at this time. Mm-hmm. I think it goes back to the history of many of the bigger and longer standing gold mines that operated through all the cycles of all the price cycles. And it's a case of once you have a mine in operation, it will operate through however that pricing cycle may be. Generally, there are obviously exceptions to that one. But gold, I think, in my view, has some of the best resilience to be able to deal with fluctuations in pricing. As long as what one is establishing and putting into production today and investigating from a resource development perspective has the ability to go into production as a low-cost producer. And I believe that that is the case with what we're looking at. So I'm pretty bullish about investing in gold.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, George. Thank you for that. That's a nice insight into your past there. And as Kenny said, almost the first time the company has been debt-free, which is always always nice. And sounds like you're well positioned to go forward and moving on with new projects, which is nice. So I'm sure it'll be an interesting story to follow. But thank you for talking to us. And Kenny, unless there's anything you want to ask George, then I think we're good.
Yeah, no, I'm all done. Just thank you very much, George, for your time coming on today. And hopefully we'll get you back on, whether it's in Market Musings or whether it's in Stockbox in the future, we'll get you back on for an update. So thanks for the time anyway.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm very happy to chat to you guys anytime.
Thank you, Kevin. George.
Cheers, George.
Thanks.
Yep.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.